Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. This is Crime Talk, and my name is Scott Reich. We have a busy docket today with a couple of changes, which I'll explain in a minute. First, Brian Laundrie. Will we ever learn the cause of death? We have a lot of Alex Murdoch news, prejudgment attachments, and should the feds get involved? Some people snapped back when I said Alec Baldwin should get lawyer up. I believe I'm correct. I'll tell you why. Assembling a jury in the Ahmaud Arbery case is proving to be a little more difficult than most thought it would be. And then finally, our dumb criminal contestant winner from last week. All right, let's get started. Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. Thanks for joining the most fact-driven, unbiased true crime channel, a channel where an experienced practicing criminal defense lawyer is going to explain to you the good, the bad, and the ugly about the law, criminal procedure, and what to expect from both the prosecution and the defense in both current true crime cases and cold cases. Now, as always, if you can't watch Crime Talk, you can always listen to Crime Talk with Scott Reich on your favorite podcasting app. And of course, if you haven't done so already, please hit that subscribe button, hit that little bell so you receive notifications of when we go live or put up new content. All right, a quick word regarding our sponsor of today's program. Please go to crimetalkprep.com, okay? Listen, unexpected emergencies happen. We all try to prepare for the unexpected, but sometimes we're all going to get caught off guard. One thing you always want to make sure is that you have an emergency food supply. So when you go to crimetalkprep.com, you'll receive $100 off your three-month emergency food supply. Now, if you're unable to purchase 3 months, that's okay. Order a small amount, but have something for an emergency. I hope you never need it, but this is for when the unexpected happens. It's better to be prepared. Remember, it's better to have it and never need it than to need it and not have it. Go to crimetalkprep.com. You'll be happy you did, and you'll have that insurance you hope you never need. Now let's get to a new segment called the opening statement. Well, I'm going to throw in a little bit of opinion in this particular segment, ladies and gentlemen. Well, let me just start it with this. We are better than this. We as citizens are better than this, okay? A woman was sexually assaulted while on a train near Philadelphia Wednesday, and riders watched, failed to intervene, and did not call 911, according to the authorities. A man who officials identified as Fiston Goy sat down next to a woman at about 10 p.m. on a train that was traveling westbound on the Market Frankfurt line toward the 69th Street Transportation Center. Mr. Goy attempted to touch her a few times, according to a spokesman from the Southeastern Pennsylvania Transportation Authority, also known as SEPTA. And the woman pushed back and tried to stop Mr. Goy from touching her. Then, unfortunately, he proceeded to rip her clothes off. That's right. She was then assaulted for at least 8 minutes, and no passengers on the train intervened. Anybody that was on that train has to look in the mirror and ask why they didn't intervene and why they didn't do something. It's unacceptable. Now, Mr. Goy, he's 35, and he's been charged with rape, sexual assault, and aggravated indecent assault without consent, among a litany of other crimes. But the authorities said that Mr. Goy was homeless and was not armed during the attack. He was being held at the Delaware County Jail on a $180,000 bond, and, you know, he'll get a public defender on this particular case. Apparently, several passengers were on the train car. The police won't say exactly how many people were there. Now, while there weren't probably a dozen people in that car, according to the police, there were enough that collectively they could have gotten together and done something. The spokesperson for SEPTA said that the investigators received reports that some passengers were actually recording the attack on their phones. Now, the police hadn't been able to confirm that, but eventually a transportation authority employee got on the train, saw what was happening, and called 911. Police officers ran onto the train, caught the man in the act, and took him into custody. The surveillance footage that the authorities are reviewing doesn't contain audio, but apparently based upon the footage that has been reviewed, it's clear that the passengers had an opportunity to intervene. The woman told authorities what had happened after Mr. Goy was in custody. She was taken to the hospital and the authorities interviewed her there. It's obvious that what this woman has endured at the hands of this guy should never have happened. It's frankly unbelievable. And the bystanders who failed to intervene, should they or could they be criminally charged as well? Normally, nobody has an obligation in which to intervene and stop a crime. Frankly, it could be dangerous. But when there are more than one person, more than one individual there, seeing somebody being sexually assaulted on a train, come on, ladies and gentlemen, somebody could have done something. And that's why I say that we are better than this, okay? Our society is going to be judged, like many other societies, on how they collectively treat the children and the women in their society. And we can do better than this. Even if somebody had walked up and said, "Are you sure something's not right? This was unacceptable. People need to intervene. Call the police when in doubt." And I'm not saying, "Oh, call the police on everything going on." But clearly, this sounds like a situation where somebody should have done something. We're better than this. Have a little intestinal fortitude and do the right thing. And it's not all about you making sure that you don't want to get involved or do anything. It's just the right thing to do. All right, let's get to more of the docket today. A lot of people heard human remains were found in Fullerton's Carlton Reserve last week after more than months of searching for Mr. Brian Laundrie, who is obviously the person of interest in the disappearance of his fiancée, Gabby Petito. Now, the remains described as simply skeletal by the Northport Police Department were confirmed to be Laundrie's after review of the dental records. Now, Brian Laundrie's remains were sent to an anthropologist for further evaluation after autopsy results came back inconclusive. And according to family attorney, no matter cause of the death was determined, the attorney said he was not given a timeline for when the anthropologist will conclude the evaluation of Laundrie's remains, which he said will ultimately be cremated. And Brian's parents, they left their home Sunday for the first time since the police told them that their son was dead. Chris reversed quickly and drove to the center of town. He was followed by a news crew. He apparently stopped, got out of the car, walked up to them, and said, "Please, let me grieve with my family." The Laundries are not planning to have a funeral for their son, according to the family attorney. The family's not having any plans for any sort of a public funeral for Brian Laundrie. I get it. And I took some flack last week as well, saying, "Hey, you know, obviously what happened to Gabby Petito was wrong. Should not have ever happened. And it would have nice to have seen somebody brought to justice for that. But let's face it, probably not going to happen with the death of Brian Laundrie." And I also have to say that, well, I was wrong. I thought Brian Laundrie was maybe, I don't know, in Cuba, out of the country, partly because of the fact that the parents didn't seem too concerned about looking for their son. I thought that was rather unusual. And then, bam, just like that, they find their son's remains. As you may recall, the parents went out last Wednesday when they suddenly decided, let's go look for their son in the 25,000-acre swamp reserve there. And as they just apparently went in further, Chris ventured off into the trail, into the woods. He was zigzagging in different areas. Apparently, law enforcement was doing the same thing. And old Roberta was walking down the trail. At some point, Chris locates what's called a dry bag. The dry bag is a white bag laying in the woods, say 20 feet off the trail. Law enforcement apparently looked into the contents of the bag at the time, and the officers showed him a picture of the phone and the backpack that law enforcement had located nearby, some distance off the trail. At that point, the Laundries were notified that there were also remains near the backpack. They were asked to leave the nature preserve. The notebook can allegedly be salvaged, and law enforcement made sure to handle it with care so they wouldn't lose any possible clues written inside. Perhaps there could be a confession. Who knows? A letter of apology. You never know. Apparently, the Northport police said they had, in fact, previously covered this area, but they were in airboats and obviously missed it. So it is what it is. The anthropologist coming in clearly states that the Autopsy revealed nothing, which is not unusual when basically you just have skeletal remains. After the decomposition, after the animals, the weather has basically taken away everything of evidentiary value, unless there was some sort of obvious gunshot or some sort of wound that you're going to be able to see in the bones. They may, well, frankly, never know whether he tripped and drowned or was sucked in by a python and strangled. You just never know, or took some sort of pill. We'll never know for sure, but the case is finally coming to an end. Next on the docket, Alex Murdoch. Things are heating up in this particular case. So a motion for injunction was filed against Alex and Buster Murdoch by attorneys for Gloria Satterfield's family. Attorneys Eric Bland and Ronnie Richter filed a motion asking a judge to appoint lawyers to watch the Murdochs' financial transaction. Bland and Richter believe this would prevent the Murdoch family from misreporting how much money they have. Now, the lawyers say they are trying to ensure that the Satterfield estate receives all the money they are entitled to receive. Alex Murdoch is currently charged with stealing over $3 million from the sons of Gloria Satterfield, the family's housekeeper who died on the property. And Alex was also arrested a week ago and was denied bond Tuesday in a court hearing regarding that matter. Now, Alex Murdoch is also facing charges relating to an assisted suicide attempt and a $10 million insurance fraud scheme. And Murdoch is being sued by his former law partners for alleged theft of funds, which could total maybe $10 million. Okay? $10 million, another couple of million from stealing estates, and who knows how much other money. What was this man spending it on? Was it gambling? Was it drugs? Partying? Is there a mistress? Was it nothing but hookers and blow? Come on, somebody's got to have an answer to where all of this money went. I'm sure the forensic accountants are going to find out, and I'm sure if the prosecutors are smart, they will say that if there's any kind of plea deal, that there must be full cooperation regarding where the money went, so it can attempt in an attempt to be clawed back. And then on top of that, Connor Cook, who is a friend of the Murdoch's deceased son, Paul, is also suing Alex Murdoch for allegedly starting a whisper campaign about Cook to take the heat off Paul following the highly publicized boating accident that took the life of teenager Mallory Beach. Now, Paul was charged with boating under the influence, but the allegations were dropped after his death. There's no case to go forward on, so he dies an innocent man. As you may recall, Paul and Maggie were both found shot to death near their summer house outside the home. Now, the state law enforcement division there in South Carolina, known as SLED, has not released the names of any suspects or announced any arrests in the double homicide case. But SLED did announce new evidence was found related to the death of Stephen Smith while investigating Paul and Maggie. And Smith was a teenager who was found dead on a rural Hampton County road. Police at the time publicly said he died following a hit and run. But investigators have cast doubt on that conclusion. We've done videos about that as well. Seems a little suspicious indeed. And obviously no arrests were made yet related to the Smith case. Now, the big question is, and it's kind of floating around there, is should federal law enforcement and prosecutorial resources be brought in to bear on the Murdoch murders and this ultimate big true crime saga? Well, state investigators and prosecutors are doing, you know, what appears to be a pretty good job regarding this disgraced attorney, Alex Murdoch, and his powerful South Carolina family and influential law firm. There appears to be a lot of corruption, allegedly, that justice may not be actually handed out. So those who trust the state to handle this case by the book have questioned whether its law enforcement and prosecutorial agencies have the resources to follow every little emerging rabbit hole that seems to be coming down. So SLED, you know, so far is living up to the words of their chief there, Mark Keel, who has repeatedly vowed to pursue justice in this case no matter where the facts lead us. Similarly, the Office of the South Carolina Attorney General, Alan Wilson, says that the handling of any charges raised during the pursuit of this inquiry, which Wilson's office did in the aftermath of the fatal 2019 boat crash that thrust the Murdoch family into the limelight some 3 years ago. Then we have Senior Deputy District Attorney General Megan Bergstead. She showed no fear of favor in her handling of that case, and she and her colleagues in Wilson's office, included Senior Deputy Attorney General Creighton Waters, are also did a great job. There's people that are concerned about judicial interference about the Murdochs, saying that somehow they're going to receive some reassurances that the judiciary is not at issue. Why? Because the circuit judge, Clifton Newman, let it be known that he was not going to grant a bond to the 53-year-old Alex Murdoch, who is at the center of this literally made-for-TV movie. So I don't think that anyone needs to be concerned about the state doing a good job, all right? So Judge Newman's denial of bond for the Murdoch on a pair of theft charges represented a clear shot across the bow for the defendant's legal team. Well, then you have to worry about the feds, which some people have said, why are the feds not stepping in? They need to be there so that there's nothing nefarious going on with the state because of all of the connections that Murdoch and his firm had in South Carolina. But then there's been talk that one of the Murdoch attorneys is trying to negotiate a backdoor plea agreement with the feds for Alex Murdoch. The goal of the ongoing plea negotiation was to strike a preemptive deal with the federal government that could conceivably mitigate some of the state charges Murdoch is facing, as well as additional charges he's more than likely going to face in the future. Now, some people familiar with the status of the investigation say there's a full-scale turf war that has erupted between the regional offices of the United States Attorney's Office in the state of South Carolina over who is going to handle various Murdoch-related matters. Specifically, the current Murdoch team based out of Charleston, South Carolina, is facing criticism from fellow federal agents and prosecutors based in Columbia and Greenville. What's the rub? Well, apparently conflict of interest, or at least alleged conflict of interest, of people in the Charleston office, which is headed up by acting United States Attorney Rhett DeHart. So what's the conflict? Well, it turns out plenty of federal agents and prosecutors are miffed over the way DeHart has jumped into the case, despite being warned by the Attorney General of the state of South Carolina that his involvement could potentially jeopardize one of the ongoing state investigations, namely the double homicide regarding Alex Murdoch's death of Maggie and Paul, his son. Mr. Wilson is said to have personally informed DeHart that federal intervention in this investigation would be counterproductive, only to be informed by the federal prosecutor that he was jumping into the case regardless due to the pressure he is receiving from the U.S. Department of Justice in D.C. Why is the Department of Justice in D.C. care anything about a little case down in a little county in South Carolina? Interesting for sure. Now, DeHart's office is facing criticism over the fact that one of its employees, a liaison to the scandal-scarred South Carolina 14th Judicial District, is the daughter of a current partner at the Peters, Murdoch, Parker, Elsroth, and Dietrich firm, PMPED. Now, PMPED and its partners are currently facing scrutiny in connection with an ongoing SLED investigation into allegations that Murdoch stole more than $10 million from the firm. And the South Carolina 14th Circuit solicitor, Duffy Stone, has already recused himself from his case due to his close proximity to the Murdoch family. In fact, until recently, Alex Murdoch was still carrying a badge as one of Stone's deputy solicitors. Helps to get out of traffic stops too, I hear. Hopefully the feds don't come in and screw everything up like they do oftentimes. I think we need to keep our faith in SLED, at least up to this point, until they prove otherwise. But so far, it seems like they got this under control. Next on the docket, Alec Baldwin. Now, I took a little bit of heat last week when I said, man, seems like Alec Baldwin may want to lawyer up and maybe not keep talking to the police down there in Albuquerque. We'll see how that turns out, but I think I'm right, and I'll explain why as we go on. First, new details have emerged regarding the incident in which Alec Baldwin fired an alleged prop gun on the set of the movie Rust that resulted in the death of the film's director of photography, Helena Hutchins. Now, according to a search warrant executed by the Santa Fe County Sheriff's Office, Baldwin and crew were setting up a shot that required Baldwin to cross-draw a revolver and point the weapon at the camera. However, thanks to a shadow that was coming into the church structure from light outside, the camera had to be adjusted to a different angle. Baldwin was working with the director and the cinematographer demonstrating how he was going to draw his revolver from its holster and where his arm would be for the new shot. While demonstrating, the firearm went off. So Joel Souza, who was also injured, explained Baldwin pointed the gun directly at the camera and fired, striking him in the shoulder and Helena Hutchinson in the chest. Souza said he had a vague memory that Hutchins was complaining about her stomach and grabbing her midsection. Hutchins was immediately attended to by on-site medics and later airlifted to the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where she was eventually pronounced deceased. And director Joel Souza said three people were handling the gun for the scene. Armorer Hannah Gutierrez-Reed reportedly handled prop guns left on a cart outside the structure they were shooting due to COVID restrictions. Assistant director Dave Halls handed one of those guns to Baldwin. According to the affidavit, Halls announced that it was a cold gun before giving it to the actor, meaning that the firearm was unloaded. As a result, Baldwin and the two people who were wounded believed the firearm was safe to use in the staging of the scene. Both the director and Russell noted that cameras were not rolling at the time as they were still setting up the shot. Souza said in the warrant that the cast and crew prepared the scene before lunch and then had their meal away from the shooting location around 12:30 p.m. He was not sure if the gun was checked again when everyone returned from lunch. However, he stated that firearms are supposed to be checked by the armorer, followed by the assistant director, before handing them to the actor. He said he was not sure if people were checked for live ammunition on their person, but stated that live ammunition should not have been anywhere near the scene. Apparently, the production is also doing its own investigation and review after crew members reportedly had other safety concerns. Steve Wolf, a special effects coordinator and theatrical firearms safety expert, said there were three errors committed that resulted in the tragedy. First, using a real gun rather than a prop gun. Second, having a live round in the gun and having people stand behind the camera in the line of fire. And third, the assistant director should not have been the one to clear the gun before the incident. That should have been the armorer's job. So what does that really mean? Well, it means, obviously, Alec Baldwin fired the weapon. Could he potentially be charged with some sort of criminally negligent homicide or reckless manslaughter? Yes, he could. Why? Because I can tell you, there are prosecutors in the state of Colorado that would say, we don't care how you got that gun. You're the one holding it. Regardless of who hits it, you never should have pointed at anybody in front of him, let alone pulled the trigger. And I've had that told to me even when you can prove that the firearm malfunctioned and discharged unexpectedly. Next, Alec Baldwin was the executive producer and owns the company that was part of this production team. He, as the individual responsible for the company, could face criminal charges for negligence. Negligence in the sense of hiring the wrong people, didn't follow the proper protocols. The armorer also has a problem. Assistant director potentially has a problem. Bottom line is, something happened. And if they can find out who was the individual or individuals that thought it would be a good idea to put a live round into that firearm, they've got big, big problems. No doubt about it. There was a lot of unrest on the set. Apparently, the union workers were basically left in disgust for not being paid for some 3 weeks, which probably explains why people are trying to cut corners, and they brought in a non-union crew to work. Disgruntled employee, you just never know. Hopefully, that casing was collected and nobody touched it with their fingers without gloves or something along those lines, so they can possibly get a fingerprint or some sort of DNA off of that casing that was kept from or that was used in this firearm. everybody's got a problem here in this particular case. Yes, the government always has to prove the mental state of mind of the individual knowingly, right? Yes, Alec Baldwin knowingly pulled the trigger to that firearm, but did he knowingly pull the trigger knowing there was a live round in there? That's what they'd have to prove. However, negligence, it's a real firearm. The prosecution could easily find experts to come in and say, you violated the firearm safety rules, and therefore you are negligent. We'll see how things shake out, or maybe nobody will be charged at all, and it's just a huge accident. Needless to say, there will be a civil case coming, although the question then becomes, since it was a workplace-related incident, is there exclusive remedy only that of workers' compensation and not a civil suit? Oh, you've got to love the law and everything that comes with it. Next on the docket, Ahmaud Arbery. Remember, they started jury selection last week. Well, the search for impartial jurors is posing a bit of a challenge in the murder trial for three men accused of killing Ahmaud Arbery. Potential jurors in the highly anticipated trial have admitted to being swayed by the video allegedly showing Arbery being shot at close range last year. It's alleged that Arbery was jogging through Satilla Shores neighborhood on February 23rd of 2020 when he was chased down by three white men, Greg McMichael, 65, his 35-year-old son Travis, and local resident William Roddy Bryan. The three men cornered Arbery, claiming they believed he was a burglar, with Travis McMichael confronting the jogger and shooting him dead with a shotgun. Bryan shot footage of the deadly incident, which went viral and ultimately resulted in charges being filed against him as well as the McMichaels. Now, several of the jurors told the court, I saw the news footage and I saw the video footage, and I've already formed a guilty opinion of the crime. Other jurors said some things you just can't unsee. Other juries are worried about sitting on a jury for a case like this. They point to potential consequences specific verdicts may have for the community. Some expressed fear of violent protests, and outside agitators apparently have been a concern as well. A couple of jurors basically said it'd be naive to think that they couldn't be real world repercussions. The one female juror added that she wouldn't let fear stop her from trying to weigh the case fairly. Another issue that has come up is that, obviously in smaller communities, is trying to find a juror because several people knew Arbery, or they also knew the defendants in this case. Obviously, it doesn't actually exclude them, but they, you know, let's try to find jurors that don't know anybody involved. Now, Kevin Goh, an attorney for Bryan, called the Brunswick community Satilla Shores, where the shooting took place, is a suburb of that city, a fishbowl where everyone knows each other. One prospective juror said Bryan looked familiar. Another said he knew a neighbor of the McMichaels who was among the first people to arrive in the scene of the shooting. Another person said a family member was among the first responders who was dispatched to the shooting. Other jurors who said that they met McMichaels at a hunting club and had known Bryan for roughly two decades said that even though he's not a close friend of either of the two men, knowing them made it difficult for him to serve as an impartial juror. And I love that people are sharing their true feelings. Let's keep going till we find the necessary pool so that every side gets a fair trial. There's also a situation where people are familiar with the Mr. Arbery's family. It was noted that on the third day of jury selection, a potential juror appeared to give a thumbs up and a nod to the Arbery family on their way out of the courtroom. Well, the Chatham County Superior Court Judge Timothy Walmsley, who's presiding over this case, wants an initial pool of 64 potential jurors from which a final panel of 12 jurors and four alternates will be selected. So far, only 23 have been picked for the pool since last week. The judge said that the selection will probably go well into this week or even the week thereafter. Next on the docket, our dumb criminal contestant winner from last week. And let me explain. We're going to announce the winner, and guess what? The dumb criminal contestant has become so popular, we've decided to make it into a YouTube short. You'll still be able to see it, but now You don't have to wait for everything. You can just jump straight to the short as well. So here's the winner from last week. The winner was Edward William Rodriguez. The 28-year-old man had been arrested for the incident at Waffle House, in which he stated that he was high and drunk and used his finger in the shape of a gun to steal, that's right, napkins. Now, you shouldn't steal things from anybody. And yes, a napkin has a thing of value, which is still a theft and a robbery and an armed robbery if you have a gun. But, sir, next time, if you're going to do something and face going to prison, make sure it's going to be worth it. Because somehow I don't think those napkins are worth it. Doubt you got to even take them to the county jail with you. Thanks for watching. Have a wonderful day. We'll see you next time on Crime Talk.